Welcome back to Beyond the Uniform. I'm Justin Asiri, and each week I meet with military veterans to learn about what they're up to in their civilian career, what they do, how they got there, and advice for other veterans seeking to do the same. Today is episode number 200 with Mike Durant.
Mike Durant, we won't leave you behind! Mike Durant!
Well, that was a clip from the 2001 movie Black Hawk Down, and that was a clip of them saying our guest today's name. He is featured in that movie. He wrote a book that is a follow-on to the movie, and as you'll see, I think that Mike, for me, personifies resilience and tenacity in his military career, where he served for over 22 years, including times where he was held prisoner in 1993 in Somalia, as that clip just alluded to. We talk about challenges of running a larger company. He got out of the military after 22 years, worked in various capacities for 6 years, and then started his own company, which he's grown now to nearly 400 employees and $70 million in revenue. But he's very upfront and transparent about the challenges of running a larger company and what that's like. And he talks about leadership and recruiting individuals, retaining families, all sorts of great things for those of you interested in entrepreneurship or just interested in business in general. As always, at beyondtheuniform.io, you'll find show notes, you'll find links to everything we discuss, but you'll find a text transcript, and you'll also find a link for a free audiobook of your choice from Audible, which also helps support the show. So with that, let's dive in to my conversation with Mike Durant. Well, joining me today in Huntsville, Alabama, is Mike Durant. Mike, thank you so much for joining me today on Beyond the Uniform.
That's my pleasure.
I wanted to give listeners a very abbreviated background on Mike. He is the president and CEO of Pinnacle Solutions, which provides a wide variety of products and services to NASA, the Department of Defense, and industry partners, including aircraft and weapon system original equipment manufacturers. In 10 years, Pinnacle has grown from a home office-based startup to over 375 employees and more than 70 subcontractor personnel operating in 14 U.S. and international locations with over $70 million in revenue. He was a member of the 160th Special Operations Aviation Regiment, the Night Stalkers, as a Black Hawk helicopter flight lead and instructor pilot. He retired from the Army as a Chief Warrant Officer for Master Aviator after participating in combat operation Prime Chance, Just Cause, Desert Storm, and Gothic Serpent, during which he was shot down and held prisoner in 1993 after a raid in Somalia, which was chronicled in the movie Black Hawk Down. His awards include the Distinguished Service Medal, the Distinguished Flying Cross with Oak Leaf Cluster, Bronze Star with Valor Device, and the Purple Heart. He was inducted into the Army Aviation Association of America Hall of Fame in 2008. And so, Mike, I wanted to focus the interview about your post-Army transition, but I could not miss an opportunity just to see if there's anything you wanted to say about the Battle of Mogadishu or your portrayal in the movie Black Hawk Down.
Well, you know, it's interesting. We're coming up on the 25th anniversary of that mission. It's hard to believe that much time has gone by. And I think there was a period of time where I could have simply said, well, everyone is certainly anyone associated with the military is familiar with the movie. And it's probably still largely true, but it has been a long time. And I think, you know, there have been a lot of other movies that have come out. And there's a lot of other stories. And Black Hawk Down doesn't quite get the visibility it got at one point. I guess I would say we're happy with it overall. You know, I think any time Hollywood sets out to retell a true story, there's probably a lot of anxiety on the part of the real participants, the actual participants, about how the story will be told and whether or not justice will be served to the story and certainly to the characters in it. And I think overall, all of us that were there feel like they did a pretty good job with it, and it's not something, you know, we would say, you know, it's just a horrible story. You know, that's not how it happened. I think generally speaking, everyone agrees it captures the essence of the battle, and it certainly captures the realism of, you know, what it's like on the ground in the middle of something like that, and then certainly the individual acts of courage and sacrifice and, you know, everything else that really is the essence of what it means to be in the military.
That's incredible. I remember, I believe I was at the Naval Academy when I saw that movie, and it did seem, you know, obviously I have no frame of reference for the actuality of that, but watching it in the audience, it felt like it didn't seem like they were trying to over-embellish things. It seems like they were trying to give a more realistic perspective rather than just hyper-heroic or embellishing things. That's great to hear that the experience for you, which must be surreal watching these events on screen, that it rings true for you.
Yeah, and I like the fact that you use the term hyper-heroic. I think that happens a lot, even in true stories. And there's a lot of reasons why they do it, but it's not really the case in the Black Hawk Down story, and I do think it's a more accurate portrayal of what you know, people's strengths and weaknesses and limitations and fears and courage and everything all combined really looks like in the heat of battle.
And one of the things I wanted to ask about is that you are the author of the book that is called In the Company of Heroes. What drove you to write this book?
So when the movie Black Hawk Down came out, I waited really several months to go see it. I just wasn't sure how, you know, what that experience was going to be like for me. So I waited and hadn't quite gotten to the dollar theater yet, but it had been out for a while, you know. And I just went by myself. I think I went with a friend of mine, but it, you know, just woke up that day and said, "All right, I'm ready. I'll go see it." And I'm sitting there in the theater, realizing, okay, this thing's been pretty successful. A lot of people have seen this movie, but the movie ends with me in captivity, and there's a short blurb at the end about, you know, what happens, you know, in the real story. And I'm thinking, okay, this is. First of all, the focus was in the right place. It was on the battle. It was on, you know, the sacrifices that Randy Shergart, Gary Gordon made, and everybody else that was on the ground there. But there's an untold story, and that is my experience in captivity. And I had taken some notes on it previously, just to capture my thoughts and not lose my memory of some of the details. And I sort of dusted it off, and I thought, all right, if I am going to act on this, now is the time. And within a couple of weeks, I made some phone calls and put together an outline and wrote most of one of the chapters and sent it off. And I was right. There was interest, and I got a book deal pretty quickly. And I'm very proud of how it turned out.
For people who are listening who might be on active duty and maybe they aspire to be an author and writer as well, what advice would you have for them? Was there anything that helped you in the writing process or helped you stick with this? Because from what I understand, it can be a very demanding and grueling process of bringing that idea to life in the written form.
It is absolutely a lot of work. It's far more work than I would have possibly imagined. And I was working full-time at the time and raising children, and, you know, there's not a lot of time in the day to begin with. And it took, and this is actually pretty fast, it took about 14 months to get the project done. And that's working pretty much every night and every weekend, you know, writing, reviewing, strategizing, reaching out to, you know, various points of contact to get you know, copyright authorization or who knows what. And it's kind of a funny story. It's funny to me. When I finally released the book and we were going out on the book tour, they scheduled some interviews for me. And one of them was with Hannity and Combs, which is, Combs is no longer on the Hannity show, but it was a pretty popular show at the time. And I remember driving in New York City, going to the studio, and I asked the guy who was with me, "So who are these guys?" I hadn't watched television in like a year and a half. I didn't even know who they were, and that just gives you an example or an idea of just how heads down we were for that whole time trying to get this thing cranked out. It is a lot of work. And it's hard, you know, it's hard to write a successful book today. First of all, there's a lot of people that do it. It's hard to find that you know, secret sauce that is gonna eventually sell, because you know, publishers aren't in it for goodwill. It's a business, so you have to figure out, you know, can I put a story together? Will it sell? Is there a market? You know, and then make those tough decisions about, you know, this is something I could really do, or maybe it's a person's passion. And if it's your passion, then do it anyway. You know, if you just get pleasure out of it, it doesn't matter if it sells. You can self-publish. But, you know, I guess so maybe that takes it up another notch. Think about, what am I trying to accomplish? Am I just trying to write for the pure joy of writing and to do something, or is this something I want to go sell? You know, for me, it was both. I felt like there was a business opportunity, and it was a story I wanted to tell. So I had the best of both worlds.
That's great. And I'm aware that there's a full range of listeners. Some are 1 or 2 years into their military service right now, and others are towards the end, and they may have closer to 20 years of service. And I believe you left the military after 22 years of service, and I'm just curious what advice you have for veterans who are in a similar position and would love to learn about what that first job search experience was like for you.
Yeah, so my first piece of advice is don't wait till the last minute to think about it. It's a big transition. There's not a lot of moments in my life where I can specifically remember the moment in time, but I remember the moment in time where I had my retirement paperwork on the desk in front of me. It was unsigned, and I was looking at it, trying to make that decision to do it or not do it, because I loved my job. And I think a lot of people that are in the military that have spent 20 years probably feel the same way. It's a great profession. It's a tremendous experience. There's so many great people. If the experience is anything like mine, there's a certain desire to continue that on forever. But you have to realize at some point that it can't continue forever, and you got to have some strategy to transition to the next phase of your life, because 20 years, 25 years, 30 years, a friend of mine's retiring this Friday. I think he's pushing 40 years in the military. It's still, he's got a lot of life left to live and a whole nother career ahead of him. So the main thing is to set yourself up to make that transition. Don't just, you know, one day wake up and say, that's it, I'm done, I'm retiring, and not have a plan. And that, you know, what that plan looks like is going to vary dramatically depending on who you are, what your skill sets are, what your desire is, you know, for post-military employment, which is, you know, most, you know, probably the biggest decision is, do I want to continue to work? And if so, you know, what am I good at? Where can I contribute? And what would I enjoy? Because nobody wants to go off and do something that they don't enjoy. And, you know, certainly not, I'm not in any way endorsing doing something just for the paycheck, but if you can get paid and enjoy it, that's the best case scenario. So for me, things that I did, I went to degree completion. Now, I did it when I was grounded, because my injuries were pretty bad. I had, you know, a year and a half to recover physically. So I made a good decision. I decided, well, I'll go to school. And, you know, there's so many great programs. They're even better now, the programs that the military offers. Take advantage of that. I will tell you that, you know, now that I have my own company, one of the first discriminators when you look at a resume is, does the person education level and experience match the job? I mean, that's number one. Everyone is looking for that. You're not going to get past the initial screening if you don't have the education level that matches up with the requirements of the position you're after. So, you know, the higher that degree can be, the better. Any degree is better than no degree, but, you know, a master's degree is going to differentiate you from someone with a four-year degree, and so on and so forth. So if there are opportunities to do that, do it. You know, some people, their career had just such an op tempo that they never had time to do that, and that's understandable. I mean, it's mission first and you know, the unit first, and there's nothing that can be done about that. But if there is ever an opportunity to get some education, get it. It's certainly cost effective to do it through a military program, and it'll really suit you well in your post-military job search. The other thing I did and this is more luck than wisdom, I got involved in the procurement side of the military, at least a little bit, but enough to start to understand it. You know, when I was an operational guy, I didn't care where the helicopters came from or, you know, what it took to sustain them or, you know, the budgets to keep these things operating. None of that mattered to me. What I cared about is it's sitting there when I need it and it has gas in it, and where that came from I didn't really care about. But there's such a huge machine that exists behind the scenes to keep the military churning, and there's jobs throughout that entire enterprise. So, you know, it could be a logistics position, or it could be an engineering position, or it could be management, or human resources, or finance. It doesn't, you know, whatever it is, there's opportunity everywhere throughout the defense enterprise. Or obviously there's a choice that some people are going to want to make, which is to completely separate from the Department of Defense or any of those related activities altogether, and that's fine. There's opportunities out there as well. The main thing we have to remember is, you know, the discipline that you probably learn while you're in the military, the work ethic, the professionalism, all those things that became a part of who you are over the time you spent in the military are all going to serve you well in your post-military career. I mean, that's the kind of employee that employers are looking for.
That's great. I mean, there's so much good advice there, but I particularly like your humility about saying that it was a certain amount of luck that brought you to the awareness of this whole procurement field, which plays a role in where we're going in the interview. But what I like about that is that I'm imagining that exposure gave you a sense of whether or not you were interested in that, whether or not you'd enjoy doing that. And then I recently republished an interview with Cal Newport, who wrote this book, So Good They Can't Ignore You. And he talks about the concept of career capital. And so in that experience, you were able to build up some part of a skill set. You were able to build up some career capital that I imagine played a role later down the role, the line for you in your career of being able to use that career capital to obtain a job and eventually start your own company.
Absolutely, and that's a perfect segue in a point I was just going to make, and that is not to underestimate yourself. You know, when you look at someone who maybe has been in the field that you're interested in longer than you have, okay, they've got that specific expertise related to that one element of the job, but what they don't have is all the other things you have, which is the work ethic, professionalism, discipline, culture, all those things that really take years to groom and develop that you're walking in the door with. So, I think it was Southwest Airlines that had said a long time ago that, you know, they hire for culture and they will train expertise. Now, that doesn't apply in every situation, but it's just an example of how, at least in their minds, it was easier to teach people how to do the technical parts of their job if they hired the right people. And if you're coming out of the military and you've had a successful military career, you're probably the right people. They just got, you know, you just have to learn the technical side.
That's fantastic. Could you talk a little bit about, we'll backtrack in a second, but could you talk through how you came about starting Pinnacle Solutions?
Yeah, so that's another, at least I find that interesting. So I retired, as you said, after 22 years, and I got a job working in the government program office, and it just wasn't a good fit for me. I mean, we have to have those folks that love that and do it and support the government directly. But for me, it just wasn't a fit. And I think part of it is I came from the special operations world, and I was there when it was still fairly young, at least on the aviation side. So we had a lot of autonomy, a lot of responsibility, and I thrived on that. And I don't thrive real well in very structured environments that, you know, where your job scope is very limited and your authority is very limited. That's just not a good fit for me. So after only 6 months or so, I realized this is just, I'm not going to make a career out of this. I had decided that. So I got a phone call from a company that was interested in opening up a business here where I live currently in Huntsville, Alabama. And I thought, okay, I'll consider this, and had some discussions with them, and we reached an agreement, and I started the office for them. And essentially what ends up happening here is I got a trial run on what it's like to start a business, but I didn't have to pay for it myself. It was someone else's dime that was being invested, and I got to understand just how difficult it is to start from literally nothing and to go out and make contact with customers and, you know, win a small piece of work and then grow on that and perform well and build trust, build confidence, build relationships, all those things that lead to successful business. And we did well. In 5 years, we brought in quite a few projects and grew the staff. I think we had 50 people here in Huntsville and lots of folks supporting us from other locations. And by all accounts, it was a success. And then that company was purchased by a large business. And all of a sudden, I'm back in sort of this structured, you know, limited responsibility, limited authority environment again, tried to get away from. And I stayed for 3 years. And although I didn't really like it, I learned a lot about how there's a reason large businesses are successful. They have great processes. They have, everything is documented. People understand how to do their jobs. There's just, a very sound logic behind the way these successful large businesses operate. And, tier one, tier two, whichever size you're talking about, they're all pretty much the same. They are successful for a reason. It's not just random chance. So it was good to get insight into some of that. But I still wasn't really happy because of the way my job responsibilities laid out. So I just decided in 2008 that I'd seen this business environment from about every angle you could. I was an operational guy. I worked on the government side and in acquisition for a little while. I was a user representative. I worked in a government program office. I'd been with a small business, been with a large business. I did business development. I did program management. So I felt like I had all these great experiences that got me to a point where if I was ever going to do what a lot of us desire to do, which is own your own business, that this was the time. And convinced my co-founder that he should come along for the ride with me. And it wasn't so much to mitigate risk on my part as it was to try to take advantage of what I thought his skill set was that he brought to the table. And he agreed. His wife was harder to convince than he was. But, that's the thing people have to understand. When you start a business, it's a family commitment. It's not something you just go do on your own. If you're married, your spouse has got to say, I'm in this with you because there is no paycheck for an undetermined amount of time. And, in my case, you're putting your house up for collateral because, you have to have operational cash. So you get a line of credit from the bank, and the collateral on that line of credit is not your business plan. It's something tangible, like a house. And that's the risk you take. If it fails, you lose it. And you do have to be somewhat entrepreneurial and be willing to take risks and have the courage to step out there on the edge a little bit if you want to be successful. But we did it, and we are, and certainly no regrets at this point in the life cycle of the company or for me personally.
That's fantastic. I just want to call out a few things for listeners. First of all, I think it's worth rewinding and listening to Mike's explanation where, from my experience, a lot of employers will often perceive military veteran applicants as very, used to being told what to do and highly structured and needing a lot of order. And what I think Mike did beautifully there was, he said he disliked hierarchy and structure, and in special forces, he really enjoyed the autonomy and responsibility. And it was an incredible little soundbite that was just off the cuff. But I think it's a great way to think of explaining your background and in some ways educating the hiring manager that for many of you listening, you're not told what to do. You have a tremendous amount of autonomy. You have a tremendous amount of responsibility. And so I thought he did a great job of educating me and listeners about that, or a potential hiring manager. And so I think that was one thing I wanted to point out. Another thing that I really appreciated in Mike's story is he collected all of this different expertise. And he talked about his experience with business development and program management and having seen a business from so many different facets that he had the expertise and tools necessary to launch in and start his own company. And of course, there's many counterexamples where someone who doesn't have subject matter expertise can start a company and completely define an industry. But I would bet money that more people follow Mike's example here of really making sure that they are learning on someone else's dime, gathering a lot of experience, and then taking out that step to start their own company. And that was the last thing I just wanted to point out is that with Mike has had an incredible military career. And then he went on to do so much beyond that. He has written an incredible book, and he has started his own company, and he gained these skills. And one thing that I really respect in your story, Mike, is that I left the military after 5 years, and I feel like since then I've been in a rush to get to my next thing. I've been in a rush to get to what I wanted to do in my career. And I appreciate that you took, over 6 years to really accumulate skills, get a sense for what you liked and disliked, realize that first job wasn't a good fit. And that's really valuable knowledge. And that equipped you 6 years after a 22-year career to start a company that's been very successful. So I think it's a good reminder for listeners to not always be fixated on the final outcome and to be willing to take some time to build up those skills to get to where you want to go.
I couldn't agree more. It's a difficult thing to do. And even though we have been successful, a couple of things along the way that might not have worked out the way they did, and I might be, tossed in the pile of folks who tried and failed. So it's a very fine line between success and failure, and the more you can do to increase your chance of success, that's sage advice for sure.
That's great. And that was, you've kind of already touched on this, but one of the things I was really curious about was you did have these 6 years of civilian work experience prior to starting and co-founding Pinnacle Solutions. You had that experience with program management and with business development. I'm wondering what advice you would give to a listener of whether or not to jump right into starting something versus taking time to work for someone else and learn on their dime prior to starting something.
Sure. And I don't want to discourage anyone because I really am a big believer in following your heart and finding your passion. That gives those of us who are fortunate enough to have found that place reason to get up in the morning, and it takes work, and redefines it. It is more of an occupation or a passion or a life mission or whatever you want to call it, and it's no longer really viewed as work, which sort of has an unpleasant connotation. The thing about it though is that there is so much that I didn't know, and I know that's not necessarily true for everyone, but even after spending all those years working for these companies, I had no idea the complexities of finance and accounting. I took accounting in college, obviously I can balance my own checkbook and manage my own finances, but when you get into defense contracting in particular and the complexities involved in the finance and accounting of an organization like this, it's mind-blowing. It really, really is. Of all the things that I thought I understood, that one area in particular is far more complex than I would have ever imagined. And, the human resources and compliance and it doesn't matter whether you're a defense contractor or not. There are laws that you have to comply with. You have to understand all those laws. And as you get larger, there's more laws that come into play. So it is a never-ending learning process. I guess that's the other piece I wanted to make sure we touched on, is that you cannot ever get to a point in life where you think, okay, I'm as far as I'm going to go. I'm not going to learn anything else. And, this is it, and just level off, because that's just not how it works. I mean, you have to continuously seek self-improvement, find ways to learn more about, what it is you want to do and how you can do it better, and never lose that drive. Otherwise, you're on the decline.
Mm. I love that. There's this sense from my own experience and from so many of the veterans I've spoken with where I think a lot of us leave the military with a tremendous amount of confidence in what we have accomplished in the military. And I think there's so much that is good about that. And then sometimes that can lead to this overconfidence of not knowing what you don't know. And what I appreciate about what you're saying is just kind of having that perspective of like, wow, like this, you know, finance and accounting, this is very, very detailed, very complex things, and it takes a while to learn that and to begin to master that. And I can't find a succinct way to articulate this, but I like that sense of adopting some humility and adopting a learning and growth mindset of realizing that even though one has learned a lot in the military, there's still so much to learn. And I don't say that as a means of discouraging anyone, but of just adopting a mindset that it's not quite simple just to parachute into running a company and just to do it flawlessly, that there's a lot of skills to build up. And some people do that by going straight to it and learning on the job, but others like Mike might take more time to build up those skills and get those honed so that they increase their chance of success. And one of the things I wanted to ask about is because of the type of work that Pinnacle Solutions does, do you have any thoughts for someone who's listening about evaluating whether or not being a government contractor after they leave the military is the right fit for them?
That's a tough one. You know, it's such a vast industry and there are so many different things within it. It's hard to characterize it all as, you know, put it all in one bucket. I guess I would say in most cases, the experience that a former service person has might be best suited, particularly if you're talking about a job specialization. Like, it's easy for me to understand because I was a pilot. So, you know, today a lot of military aircraft are flown by contractor pilots, whether it's providing flight instruction or services or, you know, deploying to theater. There's contractors flying aircraft all over the place. So that, you know, that skill set is a marketable thing in the post-military environment and in demand, depending on, you know, what platform you're talking about. Now, again, that might not be something everyone can relate to, but if as an individual you have a skill set that you learned in the military that does translate into the contract world, then there's probably demand for you. If you're good at it and you know that's something you want to keep doing, then I would say that there is probably demand for you. If I almost can't answer the question about non-defense related, because I've been in the defense industry since, you know, if you count my military career, since 1979. So I don't really understand the non-defense related aspect of business. I've not been in it. I mean, businesses operate the same way, but in terms of what it takes to be successful, it's a really different world, and I completely understand the world I'm in, and that's why I'm there, because, you know, I would have been probably lost in the forest had I gone out there and tried to do something else. But, you know, everyone has their own unique life experiences, and if that's what you as an individual understand, and that's what you as an individual think you can bring value to, then obviously that is the direction that I would encourage you to go.
That's great. And I had read somewhere that nearly 85% of the employees at Pinnacle Solutions are veterans. I'm curious if anything stands out about the strengths and weaknesses that you see in common military candidates.
So we're a little bit of a unique situation, because a lot of our work is in the aerospace industry. And like I just talked about, you know, like our largest contract with the Air Force is training KC-10 flight crews. Well, if you have to be a KC-10, which is the refuel tanker, qualified instructor pilot to fill that position for Pinnacle, there's only one place that those candidates come from. That's the Air Force. So it's, I mean, we're a little bit unique in that aspect. And I would say, you know, most defense aerospace companies are probably in that same boat if they're service providers. But that's the answer as to why so many of our people are former military. The only place they could get that experience is having served in the military. But that's not to overlook the fact that all those things we talked about earlier, you know, the fact that we can count on those people to come to work when we expect them to come to work. You know, we're going to get a full day's work out of them when they're there. They can get a clearance. You know, that's another thing we hadn't touched on yet. But if you have a security clearance, that's another big discriminator. There's a huge backlog on clearances right now, and people that don't have them are, it just takes time. You might have the skill sets required to fill the job, but if you can't get the clearance and they can't give you an interim at least, then you can't get hired because you can't do the work. So having a clearance is another huge value add for a former military person. And it's it's common sense, but probably worth noting that your actions as a person determine whether or not you keep that clearance. So having good judgment and being the kind of person you need to be anyway, but the kind of person that is going to be allowed to keep their clearance or get a clearance is going to help you as a person and then help you find employment.
And in the last 10 years, you and your co-founder have grown from the two of you to over 375 employees. I'm just curious, as you look back on this entrepreneurial journey, what has been one of the more difficult times that you've gone through, or one of the more significant challenges that you've had to overcome?
So for me individually, the most difficult challenge that I have, and I'm open about this, and I tell the staff this, is I've never led an organization this big. That's just not the job that I had in my military career. I mean, I had leadership positions, but I wasn't leading, 400-person organization. And you have to have a different approach to things, and you have to have a different mindset. You have to understand that, I can't do all 400 of these jobs. I don't have even a fraction of the expertise in particular areas that some of the people in the company have. So you have to understand, how to lead at this level. So, I guess you could say I'm sort of learning how to be, for the Army folks, a battalion commander on the fly with no formal training, But I think you do that by being open with the folks around you. I got great people around me, and we solve these challenges together. And I think we've built trust, and it makes them better, and makes me better, and in the end makes the organization better. So that's been, as a person, that's been my biggest challenge, is to try to stay ahead of the curve. Basically, we have some proposals out there that could double us again, and now you're talking, 800 people, 1,000 people. And that's a big organization. There's a lot of moving parts and pieces. You have all those people that are depending on you to make good decisions, their families, this is their livelihood. So there's a lot of responsibility that goes along with that. And I'm not shying away from it. It's a challenge, and you can't ignore the fact that a lot of success or failure is on your shoulders, and you got to be willing to take that on and try to make yourself better to succeed at it. From a company perspective, probably the biggest challenges, disappointments, have been when we haven't won programs or opportunities that we thought we were going to win. And it's competitive. I mean, there have been proposals that we have submitted where there have been 18 other bids, and they're only going to pick one. So you have to figure out, how can I be the company that the government selects for the criteria that they've established? And it's different for every opportunity, and we go to great lengths to make sure we put an offer forward that addresses all the requirements, gives them the best price, proves on paper why we should be selected. And sometimes you don't win, even though, in some cases maybe you should have won. And it's a big disappointment, because it basically takes away from what you thought the future looked like. The confidence that you exude as a person and a leader in the organization has been rattled a little bit, because now, okay, I thought we had that work. That's a big piece of work. You know, that would keep a lot of people employed for, you know, 3, 4, or 5 more years, and we didn't get it. You got to have a plan B, and you got to have a plan C and D. And, you know, I guess to put it in perspective, we number the opportunities that we chase. You know, as soon as we identify them, we put a tag number on there so we can refer to them. And I guess just to put it in perspective for the average listener, I created opportunity number 668 today. So in 10 years, we've chased, you know, nearly 700 discrete opportunities. Now, some of those are not huge, but some are enormous. And they all require strategizing and putting a plan together, and in some cases a major proposal with multiple volumes. And it's a lot of work, and it's not the kind of thing you can just walk into and figure out and do without preparation.
I really appreciate your candor on that. And from an outside perspective, it seems to me like one of your hallmarks is resilience. I can only imagine the resilience it took in Somalia and your experience there. And then, you know, in the complete opposite extreme, the thought of having submitted over 668 proposals and all, everything that goes along with that. I just imagine that you've built up this resilience to rejection and loss and all of these things. Do you have any advice for veterans listening? Because I know that as they enter the civilian workforce, there'll be rejection and there'll be, you know, these things are inevitable. Is there anything that has helped you with that you would recommend to listeners?
Well, you hit it right on the head. I was asked a few years ago, you know, to provide a quote for, I think, graduating class at a university or something. And it came to mind right away. And that is, don't be afraid to fail. I mean, if you really want to push the envelope of your capability, then you cannot be afraid to fail. If you're afraid to fail, I always use quarterbacks as an example. So I remember there was a game where Peyton Manning just started playing for the Broncos, and I think he had just started playing for them. I don't really remember. He was coming back from an injury or something. And in one game, he threw 4 interceptions. And the average person getting beat up by the media, and the team's probably not happy, and they're not happy with themselves, would question, am I done? You know, is my career over? I just threw more interceptions in one game than I ever had in my life. What did he do? He just worked harder, you know, and he just recommitted himself to his profession. He showed, you know, fearless courage and got back out there, and has now gone down in history as arguably one of the best quarterbacks to ever play the game. And that's because he was not afraid to fail. He was not afraid to throw that next pass because he knew he had the skill and he had the intellect and he knew the game and he worked hard enough to overcome those obstacles. And he, you know, I admire him, and really, you know, all professionals, not just athletes, but professionals that reach that level, that get set back but never quit. And that, to me, if you really aspire to do something amazing, you cannot fear failure. If you fear failure, you will never achieve the potential that is probably within you.
Well, Mike, this is incredible. I feel like you've given so much value to me and to listeners, and it is an honor to have you on the show. I always like to keep the last question open-ended, which is, what have we not covered that you want to make sure listeners know before we wrap up?
Oh, boy. So let's see here. I'm just going to say what first comes to mind, and that is work-life balance. You know, I think if you've been a leader in the military, you recognize that you recruit individuals, and in most cases you retain families, and it's no different in the civilian world. And it applies to you as well. You know, I could be the most successful businessman in the world, and if I worked here at the office 16 hours a day, 7 days a week, my family probably wouldn't care. They would, you know, see it as a negative thing. So you have to find a way to be successful both in your professional life and in your personal life, because if you do have a family, which most of us do, not everyone, but most do, They've helped you get to where you are and will continue to help you in the future. And you got to make sure that you're putting as much effort into those relationships and that part of your life as you are your work commitment, because they go hand in hand. If if you do, you know, overdo one and neglect the other, then something's going to suffer, and it works both ways. And I feel like I personally have done a pretty good job with that. I know some of the folks that work for Pinnacle struggle with it a little bit. Part of it is because they're so committed to the company, they are willing to just work themselves into the ground. But in the end, that doesn't help them, and it really doesn't help us, because you can't sustain that. And if we lose that, then now you got to go hire two people to backfill that one slot, and they're probably both less experienced and cost more, and in the end, everybody suffers. So try to maintain that equilibrium between doing things you like and doing things with the people that matter to you, and then being committed to your profession.
It's so relieving to hear you say that, given the success you've experienced in both the military and in the civilian sector, to see that long-term approach to having that balance and not losing sight of your family and those things that matter to you. I think that's a great message for listeners, regardless of which career path they choose in their civilian career. Well, thank you very much, Mike. I appreciate your time. And for listeners, you'll find in the show notes for this episode links to everything we discussed. You'll find multiple Wikipedia articles about Mike and other articles about him, as well as a link to his book, In the Company of Heroes, which you can buy on Amazon. Mike, thank you so much for your time today.
Oh, it's been my pleasure, and good luck to everyone.
Well, thank you so much for listening. I hope you found my conversation with Mike as energizing as I did. Special thanks to Steve Bain, our Director of Outreach, for finding Mike and getting him on the show. Thanks to Kathleen Dillon, who types up the show notes every single week and does the text transcripts, which help for those of you who don't have time to listen to the entire episode, and also helps with our search engine optimization value of the website. Special thanks to Andrew Woolridge, who does our data analytics and insights advisory. And special thanks to me for hosting and editing the show. If you're enjoying the show, the best thing you can do to help us out is tell other people who can benefit from it. One way to do that is through a positive iTunes review, but there are limitless possibilities there, sharing on Facebook, on LinkedIn, on Twitter, with your command, with whatever would get the word out to help more veterans, to help them in their civilian career. I will be back next week with more interviews with military veterans about their civilian career. Take care.